We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be talking about the life of a man who inspired a cosmic revolution. The man we're talking about is Nicholas Copernicus. And around the year 1510, he arrived at what was at the time a very radical view of the cosmos. The idea was that the sun, and not the earth, was at the center. He knew how radical this was, and because he was afraid of being either condemned or mocked or both, he kept the idea to himself and was finally persuaded to publish his work some 20 years later by a young German mathematician named Georg Rheticus. This morning in this hour of the show, we'll be talking with science writer Deva Sobel, and she'll share with us the story of these two men and how their meeting changed the way that we see the world, and perhaps more than that, the universe. And that is the subject of her newly published book, A More Perfect Heaven, How Copernicus Revolutionized the Cosmos. It's published by Walker and Company. It's just out now. And she's traveling around the country talking about the book, and we're pleased that she could spend some time with us to talk about it this morning. She's the author of a number of bestsellers, including Longitude, Galileo's Daughter, and The Planets. She is co-author of the Illustrated Longitude, and as I say, she's joining us by phone. Questions are welcome. Questions, comments, 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. You may also send us an email. That's will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. So at any point here, people can be involved in the conversation. We just ask people to be brief if they can, so we can keep moving along. But anyone who is interested in calling in can do that. And Ms. Sobel, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Pleasure.
We appreciate it. I was kind of tickled by one of the things that I read here about you. This was a little Q&A about this new book that was published in New Scientist, which they headlined, Why I Fell for Copernicus. And in that same article, they mention her admission, your admission of having a long-term crush on Galileo, which makes one wonder, do you really go for scientists or is it astronomers in particular?
I think it's people with difficult ideas who run into trouble. That has always appealed to me.
She apparently, you had been thinking about this, or perhaps wanting to write about Copernicus, actually for a long time, when you realized that he developed these ideas when he was relatively young, but he knew just how revolutionary they were. And that it wasn't until this second man, and we'll talk about both of them, came along that he really persuaded, that is, Rheticus, persuaded Copernicus that he should actually go ahead and publish his ideas.
Yes, the concept of their meeting, imagining what that was like, these two men from different countries, different religions. In fact, because of the Protestant Reformation, which was new then, Rheticus was illegal. He was an illegal alien in Copernicus's Catholic village. All the Lutherans had been banished. But somehow Copernicus managed to keep him there for 2 years. And the idea that the 25-year-old could convince the 66-year-old to do what he'd avoided doing all his life struck me.
Yeah.
And I remember learning about their meeting and thinking that it would make a great play.
This, and just to underline here the difference between the two men that makes this meeting, you would think, unlikely. Copernicus was actually, and he was an officer of the church. He was not a priest, but he was an officer of the church. He was
exactly,
Catholic.
An administrator.
He lived in Poland. And Rheticus lived in Germany. He was a Lutheran. Even the fact that they would meet, that Rheticus could actually go as a Lutheran to this area where everybody was Catholic and the Lutherans had been chased out, that just even all that seems rather unlikely.
Right. And then you have the whole rearrangement of the universe.
Well, maybe we should start, or I should have you start by talking a little bit about what at the time was the prevailing view of the cosmos.
Yes. Well, the prevailing view, since people started noticing such things, was that the Earth is at rest. It certainly feels that way to us even now. We, even young children, talk about how they know the Earth turns every day on its axis and moves around the sun every year. But we know those things only because we've been taught. It's not something you would ever figure out by watching the sky. And it certainly looks as though the stars are moving around the Earth. And so the whole challenge to astronomy was to figure out how to make sense of all the different motions. Because if you really watch from night to night and pay attention, you see how the planets move against the background of the stars and how they sometimes look brighter than at other times. And they often change their speed and sometimes even change their direction. And so to figure out a way of calculating those things, and of course the main reason people wanted to calculate the positions of the planets was to be able to cast horoscopes. It has long been felt that whatever goes on in the heavens has some kind of effect on the Earth. People used to think that the planetary positions could help predict the weather and the success of crops, and also the rise of new religions, new kingdoms, and also the fall of religious sects and national entities.
So
astrology was very important.
Well, in fact, we obviously today we see these two things as being separate, and one is a science and one is not. That is astronomy and astrology. Galileo Copernicus was not an astrologer, but at the time, did people really draw much of a distinction between astrology and astronomy?
It's interesting. We have a perception of Copernicus as not being an astrologer, but the fact is, he just never said anything about it. And some scholars are now questioning whether he might well have had an interest in astrology that he just didn't talk about in his writings. So at the time, astronomy and astrology were intimately related. It was the same group of people. But even among astrologers, there was a division then between the serious astrologers, who were looking at global events, the prediction of floods, plagues, wars, and the not-to-be-taken-seriously astrologers who were looking at what date should you have your wedding, what does today look like for you personally. Even 500 years ago, many people considered that a frivolous use of the knowledge. And so astrologers were warring with each other about the best way to use this important information. And Rheticus was an avowed astrologer, but believed in the grander scale use of astrology, and had a feeling that Copernicus's theory would further the course of astrology.
So the idea, his idea was that this was what they wanted to do was sharpen their ability to do mathematical analysis of how things move. They weren't really thinking about so challenging the way people thought about the universe and the place of the Earth, or was he?
Right. They were interested in having a way to predict the positions of the planets, forward and backward, to be able to know from your mathematical theories where the planets were on any given date. That was very important. And the master scientist whose book was read by everybody, a book from the second century, by the astronomer Ptolemy, was definitely based on an Earth-centered plan. And Ptolemy had fiddled a little bit with perfectly circular motions. There was a belief that because the heavens were perfect, all the motions of the planets should proceed at uniform speeds and be in perfect circles. It's hard to get them to do that because, as we know today, they don't really move around the Earth, and they don't really move in a circular path, and they do change their speed. But Copernicus was clinging to this ideal vision of the heavens and was trying to return to a pure ideal. And something made him, the fact that the Earth's movement around the sun actually shows up in the movement of all the other planets, impressed him when he was studying this motion. And it emboldened him to put the Earth in orbit and say that everything was moving around the sun. And he might have done it at first just as a mathematical test, not to say that the universe was actually constructed that way, but just that the calculations might make more sense.
So
but when he switched places between the sun and the Earth, an extraordinary thing happened, which was that the planets lined up in order of their speeds. Astronomers knew that Mercury was the fastest moving planet, and Venus was a little slower, and Saturn, being the farthest known planet, was the slowest one of all. And when the sun was at the center, there seemed to be a reason for the different speeds and for the decrease in speed with distance from the sun.
So suddenly
and that
they
must have given Copernicus the sense that he had hit on the true order of the planet.
Suddenly they did not need some sort of tortured explanation to try to reconcile the idea that the Earth was at the center, everything went around it, everything went in these perfect circles. There was that, but then when they actually looked and saw the way things worked, obviously that there was something wrong there. It didn't really square with this idea, and so they tried to come up with all sorts of ways to get the two things to go together. So when he simply took the sun and put it in the middle, then suddenly the movements that they observed actually made sense.
Yes, you could say now the planets aren't really moving backwards. It's just that the Earth is catching up to a slower planet, moving past it. And that's what gives you the appearance in the sky of the other planet moving backwards. So that was a very logical explanation, but it did not go over very well.
Well, and he obviously must have known that it wouldn't go over well, and that was the reason that for all of those years, he essentially kept it to himself.
Yes, it was partly fear. It was also working really hard to perfect these ideas and all the mathematics that went with the idea so that he would have a compelling argument to publish. And so that required countless calculations, many actual observations of the planets, judging their positions against the background stars. He didn't have anything like a telescope. That came later. But he had measuring instruments that helped him define the positions of the planets.
There's something that I just think it's a curious detail, because we so associate him with cosmology and with astronomy, that he used the scientific instruments of the time that were available to him, but one thing that he did not have was a telescope.
Right. But there's an awful lot you can learn about the heavens without a telescope.
Let me introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus, Deva Sobel. She's a science writer. She is the author of several books, including Longitude, Galileo's Daughter, and The Planets. Her new book is about Copernicus. The subtitle, How Copernicus Revolutionized the Cosmos. A More Perfect Heaven is the title of the book. Walker is the publisher, and it looks at how it is that Copernicus arrived at this idea, maybe not the first, but the one who really, in a complete sort of way, worked out how things work, the idea being that rather than the sun, rather than the Earth being at the center and stationary, that everything was moving and that the Earth and the other planets revolved around the sun, not the other way around. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also email will-talk at illinois.edu. How did Rheticus become aware of Copernicus and his work?
When Copernicus first came up with his idea, he wrote it out as a letter, a brief summary of the idea, and sent it to probably one or two other mathematicians he would have known from his university days or from the time he spent in graduate studies in Italy. He studied both canon law to become a churchman, and he also studied medicine. He was the bishop's personal physician. So the way scientists, they used that term then, but scientists got ideas across to their peers was by letter. And if you received an interesting letter about a new idea, you might copy it over a few times to send it to other people you knew. And so the concept had been out and about from approximately 1510. And so it was known that this Polish canon had put the Earth in orbit around the sun. And the letter that Copernicus originally wrote also said that he was working on a big book that would give a detailed explanation of the theory and all the supporting mathematics. So people interested in those subjects were waiting for this book to come out. And Rheticus was a professor of mathematics at Martin Luther's own university in Wittenberg. And he took a leave of absence. He probably got into a little mischief. But he was much loved at the university because he was so brilliant. And he went visiting other astronomers around Germany. And in Nuremberg, he learned about Copernicus. He also met the foremost printer of scientific texts at that time in Nuremberg. And so when Rheticus went to visit Copernicus, he not only wanted to see the idea made public, but he also had a very good idea of who could make that happen. And some people think he may have even acted as the publisher's representative.
At the time, apparently, where Copernicus lived, there was no one who could have printed this book.
That's right. Copernicus, in a small town in the north of Poland, even in the big city in Poland, there wasn't a scientific printer as there was in Nuremberg. So by the time Rheticus arrived, that was 1539, it was almost 30 years people had been waiting for this big book from Copernicus.
Do you think that if it had not been for Rheticus, would the book ever have been published?
It's a question, because he seems to have needed a push, but he also needed more information, and Rheticus actually brought that information. Rheticus had been given observations of Mercury by another astronomer, observations that Copernicus had not been able to make by himself, and that was an element he'd been waiting for. So Rheticus brought many good things when he arrived, even though his presence must have made Copernicus crazy.
Yeah.
My original idea of writing the play is included in the book, imagine the difficulty of keeping this illegal immigrant in the village for all that time when the bishop had not only issued an edict banning them, but had a personal argument with Copernicus over the issue of Copernicus's female housekeeper, whose presence really annoyed the bishop, and he leaned on Copernicus to fire her.
Just one more point, and I have a caller here I want to get to. I think if a book like this appeared today that was perhaps mainly the work of one person, but where a second was important because they contributed to it, not only it contributed content, but it contributed to its being published, you would think that the name Rheticus would have been, his name would have been on it, or at the very least, right there at the beginning of the book, Copernicus would have said something like, I could never have completed the work without the valuable contributions of Georg Rheticus. Well, nothing like that is included in the book. There is no acknowledgement of Rheticus and his contribution.
That's true. And what there is at the beginning of the book is a dedication to Pope Paul III. In my play, I suggest that Copernicus wanted to acknowledge Rheticus publicly and thank him in the book, and that Rheticus himself pointed out that that would be impossible, that Copernicus, as a Catholic, could not acknowledge the help of a Lutheran on this work that was going to be dedicated to the Pope. But Rheticus, before Copernicus' book was published, Rheticus put out a summary, longer than Copernicus' original summary, but not nearly as long as Copernicus' big book, for which he did take credit. He wrote it as a letter to a mentor of his in Nuremberg, probably the very person who had informed him of Copernicus' work, in which he laid out the basic arguments and tried to soft-pedal a little bit the idea of the sun being moved from the perfect heavens into the unfavored place at the center that the earth was thought to occupy. Mm. So Rheticus's name was already associated with the idea to people who were interested in these subjects.
Well, I have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. On
right.
Our toll-free line, someone over listening in Belgium, not that far away, line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I hope Mr. Inge doesn't think this is too far off the topic, but it's pretty central to the whole topic you have. We in the West, or at least Western Europeans, have always assumed that Copernicus came up with the idea that the sun is in the middle of the solar system. But we also realize that prior to this time, before Copernicus, people were destroying manuscripts in Alexandria, burnt down a whole library full of information. Information in northern India and China had not gotten to them very much. Also, the Mesoamericans had watched the skies for a long time, and the Spanish totally destroyed their libraries without even looking at what they were in. How do we know that other civilizations hadn't already figured this out well before Copernicus?
Oh, that's a very good question. And in fact, Aristarchus in Greece in the 3rd century B.C. came up with this very idea. But his book on the subject was destroyed, as you said. Another book of his called On the Sizes and Distances of the Sun and Moon did survive, and it was a book Copernicus read. And he mentions Aristarchus. But the information about Aristarchus's sun-centered vision didn't become known until after Copernicus's death. If he'd known about it, he probably would have mentioned it, because it was very good in Copernicus's day to refer to ancient wisdom. He had also seen manuscripts of Arabic astronomers who had raised the same problem with Ptolemy that Copernicus responded to. And at least two Islamic mathematicians figured out solutions to making the heavenly motions appear more perfectly circular. And they did it without having the Earth and Sun switch places. Copernicus must have seen those manuscripts probably when he was a graduate student in Italy, because he heavily borrowed that mathematics. But his idea of putting the sun at the center seems to have been original with him, in that he had no knowledge of any prior suggestion of that.
Thank you very much.
He tries to say in the opening of his book how ancient scholars thought about various things, that maybe the earth moved on a wheel around a central fire, or other ideas that hinted at motion. But no one had ever created a completely integrated system like his.
Well, again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email us will-talk@illinois.edu. As we've explained, that there had been this prevailing view that said that the Earth was the center of everything, and that in that that's underpinned by scripture that says that the Earth is at the center. It's fixed. It doesn't move. Everything, it's the center of creation. Everything goes around that. So you might think, on the one hand, if you just look at it as a pure matter of science, you might think, well, it's revolutionary in the sense that it's a big change in the way people see things. But there's a different level on which this is revolutionary, because it does challenge the idea that the Earth is at the center and that human beings are at the center. And that you would think that would be something that the church, the established church, would have a real problem with.
Well, it's an interesting question, because Copernicus is always blamed for removing humanity from the center of the universe. Mm. But in that ancient vision of the earth at the center and all the heavenly bodies going around the earth, the true realm of God and the angels is beyond the stars. So the earth is really the farthest removed from the heavens. And it's a place that is characterized by change and death and decay, whereas the heavens are perfect and eternal. So I think the bigger problem was to put the sun, which is a heavenly body, in that bad place at the center, and take the earth with all its problems and elevate it to the status of a wandering star.
We're talking this morning in this hour of Focus with Dava Sobel. She's a science writer. We're talking about Copernicus and how his idea that the Earth was orbiting the sun and not the other way around changed the cosmos and the way we see it. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Support comes from Subaru of Champaign County, located on Route 45 in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieves zero landfill status, with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The show is on weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and we have 10 different topics, 10 different guests throughout the week. In the second hour today, we'll be talking about geographic information science, this business of trying to figure out where we are and where things are, and talk about some of the modern tools that are employed in geographic information systems. Our guest will be Michael Goodchild. He is a professor of geography at the University of California, Santa Barbara, where he's also director of the Center for Spatial Studies. And he's here visiting. We'll talk with us in the second hour. Also, tomorrow morning, we'll be talking with musician and actor Ronnie Cox. Now, that may not be a familiar name to you, but if you saw his photo, you would recognize him from many films. His very first one was the movie Deliverance, and he was the guy that was involved in the famous banjo-guitar duo. Well, he's also well-known, perhaps less well-known, but also known for being a musician and playing in the country and folk vein. And he's going to be here at WILL next month for an event to raise funds for the station. And we'll talk about that and talk with him about his career as an actor and musician tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour. You can get the schedule and listen to past programs by going to our website, that is WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour, we're talking with Deva Sobel. She is the author of A More Perfect Heaven, How Copernicus Revolutionized the Cosmos. It's published by Walker. She's also the author of the bestsellers Longitude, Galileo's Daughter, and The Planets. And questions are welcome. Again, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You know, what I think is interesting, particularly if people think about how the church reacted to Galileo for making the same sort of arguments as Copernicus. When when the book was published, it really didn't seem like it didn't set off the same kind of reaction in the church, and that really didn't happen until sometime later with Galileo.
That's right. When Copernicus's book came out, of course, it was heavily mathematical, written in Latin. It was obviously directed at a very specialized audience. And people read it who were mathematicians. And a lot of them just skipped over the first parts where he talked about changing the order of the planets. The Pope, to whom it was dedicated, probably didn't read it, but gave it to one of his theological advisors, who hated it, who took all the offense that Copernicus had feared, but then suddenly died, so didn't make much trouble for the book. The book originally came out in 1543, and Galileo did not perfect the telescope until 1609. And when he used it to look at the heavens, first thing he saw was that the moon was not some crystalline structure, but it looked like a big rock, like the Earth. It had mountains and valleys. So that was the beginning of observational astronomy and of really changing the way people thought about the heavenly bodies. Mm-hmm. Then he discovered that the planet Jupiter had four moons in orbit around it. So there was evidence that the Earth was not the only center of revolution that could be observed. And what's more, Jupiter was moving and could carry those moons along with it. So what was to stop the Earth with only one moon from doing the same thing? One of the arguments against the Earth's motion was, how could it carry the moon along with it? Well, there was Jupiter. So Galileo began to write and publish about the Copernican idea, which he'd known about but had been timid about mentioning. Now he had all these interesting discoveries. And he wrote in Italian. So that brought the information to an entirely different, non-specialized audience. And that's what really drew the church's attention. What was the point of talking to the people about these things? And they felt it was dangerous and effectively silenced him in 1616 with an edict that put Copernicus's book on the Index of Prohibited Books. It wasn't really banned. It was called suspended until corrected. And about 4 years later, corrections were issued, specific statements that had to be edited by anybody who owned the book. And in fact, Galileo's copy of Copernicus survives, and you can see that he dutifully made those corrections.
Really, if you had the book that you were expected to, and they told you that it should be changed, you were expected to do that yourself?
You were expected to do that. But it's funny, people in Italy tended to do it, and outside of Italy they tended not to do it. So even though the corrections were issued in 1620, the book stayed on the index for 200 years.
Copernicus, he's one of these people that is remarkable in the sense that not only did he have this significant achievement in this area of mathematics and astronomy, but he also, as you mentioned, he was a physician. He was a scholar in other areas. He worked as in both the political and economic realms. This was a man of many abilities.
Yes. tremendous gifts, tremendous energy directed toward whatever question he was trying to solve. Another thing he did that I thought was so interesting was just as part of his regular job with the church, he had to administer the peasants who worked the church land, and he kept records of all of those affairs. He did that for about 3 years. And you can see in those records how fairly he treated people. He was very mindful that things would be difficult for elderly people who didn't have children helping them with their work. And he, where he could, he helped.
This book, the big influential book, was published very shortly before Copernicus died. And I guess there actually is even a story that on his deathbed, someone presented him a copy of the book.
Oh, it's more than a story.
So it's actually documented
that it did happen. Because Copernicus's closest friend wrote a letter to Rheticus to tell Rheticus about the death. And while the book was being printed, sections of it were actually sent to Copernicus to look over, to proofread. And while that was going on, in December of 1542, he suffered a stroke, and he was left paralyzed, and his condition gradually worsened over the following months as the book was completed. But when the last bit was printed, it was sent to his town, and the person taking care of him brought it to him and put it in his hands. So it wasn't a bound copy of the book. It was just the last part. And at that moment, he died, almost as though he'd been holding on to know that it was done. And then he could let go.
So Rheticus, the man who is so important here, and as you've said, it's one wonders whether this book ever would have been published without him. He was much younger. What happened to him then in the years after Copernicus died?
He had many adventures and misadventures. He became professor of mathematics at another university and apparently seduced one of his students so that the student's father pressed charges against him, and for the crime of sodomy, a crime which was at that time punishable by burning to death. And rather than face the charge, Rheticus immediately left town and wrote books about mathematics, did this and that to further the Copernican idea, and despite his own dire prediction for his own early death, he lived to be 60 years old.
The book, one thing you actually mentioned, and I really didn't mention it directly, the book has an unusual form in that in the middle there is a play. And this is something that also you say you'd been really interested in doing for a long time, and maybe given that you're as an undergraduate, you studied theater history, is not maybe not real surprising that you might want to try your hand at doing that, although at the same time you are a journalist and not a fiction writer. How did you come to this idea that you wanted to write a play about this, particularly this relationship between Rheticus and Copernicus, and how it is that Rheticus managed to persuade Copernicus that after all these years that he really should get this into print?
I thought that was a dramatic moment, and a moment that had reverberations throughout history, because that book was so important. Even today, it's important. If a copy comes up at auction, it will go for well over $2 million. So that really appealed to me. I also knew that Copernicus had published very little, that the personal material, any letters of his, that was a scarce resource. There were only 17 known letters. And I wasn't sure there was enough to do a thorough biography. I researched the subject thoroughly, thinking only about writing a play, which was hard because, as you say, I'm a journalist. I've spent my whole life trying not to make up things. So when I was actually writing the play, it proved far more difficult than I imagined. But then, when I took the turn at my editor's suggestion to write a book around the play, that was great because I got to tell the whole true story. And the narrative is continuous. It goes up to the play, and then it picks up again after the play. But if you skip the play, the story would just flow. So the knowledge that I had told the story to the best of my narrative nonfiction ability, I had done right by all the characters, now I could go back, rewrite the play, and not worry about making up things, mm-hmm. and not worry about pushing the drama to extremes and letting the characters really rip.
The play is titled And the Sun Stood Still,
yeah.
and it's here in the book. And I think I read somewhere that there is actually some plan that it will be performed.
Oh, there's a great wish and hope. I think it will happen. And the title is text from the Book of Joshua, which was the argument Copernicus feared would be held against him, and was actually held against him by a couple of people. The idea, if the sun were actually still at the center of the universe, as Copernicus claimed, then why would Joshua have had to tell it to stand still?
Hmm.
So that seemed like the perfect title for it.
So there still were at there's the idea before was that the Earth was at the center. It was still. So then when the two were swapped, then there was not this larger idea. It was, yes, well, the sun is in motion, too. Everything is in motion. They just went from having the Earth at the center standing still to the sun at the center standing still?
Right. The sun was still, and also the stars could now be still.
Mm.
And that the reason we see the stars wheel overhead every night is because the Earth is turning on its axis.
Let's talk with someone else here who is listening, someone who's calling in on a cell phone, line number one. Hello.
David brought up the question of why Copernicus didn't arouse the Pope's anger, but Galileo did. And I'm not sure I was interrupted at some point, but there's another character who enters into this story, and that is Bruno. And he came in to the story between Copernicus and Galileo. And while his work looks superficially, or to someone who's not terribly knowledgeable, as being quite like that of Copernicus and Galileo, it is in reality a metaphorical diatribe aimed at the church. And the church leaders probably had every reason in the world to suppose Galileo was doing the same thing.
Yes, Bruno definitely came between Copernicus and Galileo, and he did mention the idea of infinite worlds, not only a sun-centered system of planets, but many of them, which raised the question of salvation. And had, if there were other Earths, had they also been visited by a savior? And because Bruno was burned at the stake in 1600, some people think that Galileo might also have worried about being burned at the stake. But Bruno was a true heretic. He was excommunicated from two churches, and his ideas about cosmology were peripheral to his denial of the virgin birth and of Christ's divinity. So he was in very big trouble on several counts.
And I think it made the church much more sensitive towards someone like Galileo than they would have been otherwise. I think they truly thought that Galileo was expressing heretical beliefs, not scientific beliefs. So I think
the church at the time felt it was empowered to judge science as well as theology.
Well, he didn't really make a separation. No.
Right.
Well, thank you. It's a most interesting book, and I'm going to have to read it.
All right. I hope you enjoy it.
Thank you for the call. We have maybe about 5 minutes or so left in this part of Focus. And our guest is Dava Sobel. She's a science writer, and her new book is A More Perfect Heaven. The subtitle is How Copernicus Revolutionized the Cosmos. And someone wants to call in here quickly. We can get him in the last couple of minutes. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. There are certainly some things known about Copernicus, but then there are various and sundry details of his personal life that we do not know. You said that in writing the play and in the other parts of the book, you really wanted to have some, based on research, you wanted to have some basis for what it is that you wrote. And at the same time here, you're imagining something that did indeed happen, but we really don't know what the interaction was. How did you think about that? And were there things that you might say, well, I have reason to believe certain things based on what I know about Copernicus, but I can't tell you for sure.
Right. Well, there, in these very few letters that survived, the 17 letters, three of the letters deal with the female housekeeper and how angry the bishop was about this woman of questionable character living in the home of a church canon. So that's known. The record is she was there. He defended her, tried to keep her on. But what was the nature of their relationship? That's really not known. Was Copernicus truly involved with her, or was he just accused by idle tongues? And so for the purpose of the play, I needed them to be in love, because a play has to have conflict. A play is not a history lesson. It's not an astronomy lecture. My first draft had Copernicus giving a lengthy explanation of his theory, which of course had to fall away. There had to be other ways of getting the idea across. And I was very challenged by that and really have learned a lot and enjoyed the process of how you say something on stage without saying it in so many words.
Hmm. One more caller at least here. We have someone in here where we are, Champaign County, to talk with. This is line one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Do you spend any time talking about the paradigm shift? That's the buzzword that came about because of Thomas Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolutions and his earlier work on called the Copernican Revolution, and what the deal he makes of it. I just wonder whether you
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that, because many people read those two books by Thomas Kuhn, The Copernican Revolution and The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And his idea was that most scientists do what he called normal science, and then someone like Copernicus comes along with a different idea that turns the field upside down and changes what everybody does for the next period of time. I don't really talk about it because Kuhn is modern and had a modern view of it. So I didn't use words like paradigm shift, but I certainly acknowledge him in the bibliography.
Yeah, world spinning, I guess, is the impact of just the idea of looking up in the heavens and thinking everything is actually completely different than what one was presupposed.
Yes, and that, I feel that's happening again in our own time with recent discoveries and the knowledge that all the stars and galaxies, the planets, everything that we can see visually is probably only about 4% of the universe. So not only are we not at the center, we are just a little part of a little froth of stuff, and that could make you feel insignificant or could make you feel extremely special, depending on how you choose to look at it.
Thanks very much.
All right, thank you. We're down to the point here. We have maybe about a minute or two, and I'm just curious. As I mentioned a little earlier, that when you studied theater history when you were an undergraduate, but that also that you've now had this long career writing about science, have written now several successful books, and before that spent a number of years doing science reporting for the New York Times. How did you get into being a science reporter?
Because I was so interested, I'd gone to the Bronx High School of Science, and my parents were both scientists, so I always had that interest. But I loved to write, and I'm 64, so when I was in school, there was no designated career path in science writing. And I had a very unhappy time in college, changing majors almost every term. And I fell into science writing backwards later, because I was a newspaper reporter during the year of the first Earth Day. So I was doing the work of a science writer even before I'd heard that term. And I've been doing more or less the same thing ever since. If someone had said science writing to me when I was 15 or 16, I probably would have jumped at it.
Well, just to finish, and I apologize because I know on the one hand writers are always asked these questions, but here you've put in a lot of work on this particular project and you're talking about it, but I'm sure that people ask, what do you have in mind, something for the next book?
Yes, there's always a next idea. I'm very interested in the women who were hired at the Harvard College Observatory in the late 1800s, early 1900s, to work as human computers.
Oh, the calculators. They called them calculators.
Yes. So they did all the mathematical work associated with the astronomical observations. They were not allowed to use the telescope, but the director, Edward Pickering, thought that women would do careful work. He felt that a lot of his male employees were sloppy, and that women would be careful, and furthermore, they would work for cheap, which was also true, because the women he hired were very happy to have that kind of job. And they were extraordinary, not only for what they learned to do there at the observatory, but what they went on to do. One of them became the first female professor at Harvard. Another became the first female director of a freestanding astronomical observatory. Another one figured out a distance scale for judging the size of the universe. They really did extraordinary things.
Well, we'll have to leave it there with that tease. People can look forward to that book.
Okay.
Right now, if you want to read the work of our guest, Dava Sobel, her most recent is A More Perfect Heaven, How Copernicus Revolutionized the Cosmos. And Ms. Sobel, thanks very much.
Thank you.